Sleep didn't come, but Punkin, the girl from the stocks, did. She was free as a bird now, sexual enticement or no sexual enticement. Walking barefooted across the town common of whatever Puritan village it was that she inhabited, and she was gloriously alone. There was no need to walk with her eyes decorously cast down, so that some passing boy might not catch her gaze with a wink or a grin. The grass was a deep velvety green, and far away, on top of the next hill, this has to be the world's biggest town common, Jessie thought. A flock of sheep was grazing. The bell Jessie had heard before was sending its flat, monotonous peals across the darkening day. Punkin was wearing a blue flannel nightie with a big yellow exclamation point on the front. Hardly Puritan dress, although it was certainly modest enough, covering her from neck to feet. Jessie knew the garment well, and was delighted to see it again. Between the ages of 10 and 12, when she had finally been persuaded to donate it to the rag basket, she must have worn that silly thing to 24 slumber parties. Punkin's hair, which had obscured her face completely while the neck stock held her head down, was now tied back with a velvet bow of darkest midnight blue. The girl looked lovely and deeply happy, which didn't surprise Jessie at all. The girl had, after all, escaped her bonds. She was free. Jessie felt no jealousy of her on this account, but she did have a strong desire, almost a need, to tell her that she must do more than simply enjoy her freedom. She must treasure it, and guard it, and use it. I went to sleep after all, I must have, because this has got to be a dream. Another cramp. This one not quite as terrible as the one which had set fire to her solar plexus, froze the muscles in her right thigh, and set her right foot wagging foolishly in the air. She opened her eyes and saw the bedroom, where the light had once again grown long and slanting. It was not quite what the French call l'heure bleue, but that time was now fast approaching. She heard the banging door, smelled her sweat and urine and sour, exhausted breath. All was exactly as it had been. Time had moved forward, but it had not leaped forward, as it so often seems to have done when one awakens from an unplanned doze. Her arms were a little colder, she thought, but no more or less numb than they had been. She hadn't been asleep, and she hadn't been dreaming. But she had been doing something. I can do it again, too, she thought, and closed her eyes. She was back on the improbably huge town common the moment she did. The girl with a big yellow exclamation point sprouting up between her small breasts was looking at her gravely and sweetly. There's one thing you haven't tried, Jessie. That's not true, she told Punkin. I've tried everything, believe me. And you know what? I think that if I hadn't dropped that damn jar of face cream when the dog scared me, I might have been able to squeak out of the left cuff. It was bad luck, that dog coming in when it did. Or bad karma. Bad something, anyway. The girl drifted closer, the grass whispering beneath her bare feet. Not the left cuff, Jessie. It's the right one you can squeak out of. It's an outside shot, I'll grant you that, but it's possible. The real question now, I think, is whether you really want to live. Of course I want to live! Closer still. Those eyes, a smoke color that tried to be blue and didn't quite make it, now seemed to peer right through her skin and into the heart of her. Do you? I wonder. What, are you crazy? Do you think I want to still be here, handcuffed to this bed when... Jessie's eyes, still trying to be blue after all these years and still not quite making it, slowly opened again. They gazed around the room with an expression of terrified solemnity. Saw her husband, now lying in an impossibly twisted position, glaring up at the ceiling. I don't want to still be handcuffed to this bed when it gets dark and the boogeyman comes back, she told the empty room. Close your eyes, Jessie. She closed them. Punkin stood there in her old flannel nightie, gazing at her calmly. And Jessie could now see the other girl as well, the fat one with the pimply skin. The fat girl hadn't been as lucky as Punkin. There had been no escape for her, unless death itself was an escape in certain cases, a hypothesis Jessie had become quite willing to accept. The fat girl had either choked to death or suffered some sort of seizure. Her face was the purple-black color of summer thunderheads. One eye bulged from its socket. The other had burst like a squeezed grape. Her tongue, bloody where she had bitten it repeatedly in her last extremity, protruded between her lips. Jessie turned back to Punkin with a shudder.
"I don't want to end up like that! Whatever else may be wrong with me, I don't want to end up like that! How did you get out?"
"Slid out," Punkin replied promptly. "Slid out of the devil's hand, oozed on over to the promised land." Jessie felt a throb of anger through her exhaustion.
"Haven't you heard a single word I've said? I dropped the goddamn jar of Nivea. The dog came in and startled me, and I dropped it. How can I..."
"Also, I remembered the eclipse." Punkin spoke abruptly, with the air of one who has become impatient with some complex but meaningless social formula. You curtsy, I bow, we all join hands. "That's how I really got out. I remembered the eclipse and what happened on the deck while the eclipse was going on. And you'll have to remember, too. I think it's the only chance you have to get free. You can't run away anymore, Jessie. You have to turn and face the truth." "That again? Only that and nothing more?" Jessie felt a deep wave of exhaustion and disappointment. For a moment or two, hope had almost returned, but there was nothing here for her. Nothing at all.
"You don't understand," she told Punkin. "We've been down this path before, all the way down. Yes, I suppose that what my father did to me might have something to do with what's happening to me now. I suppose that's at least possible. But why go through all that pain again when there's so much other pain to go through before God finally gets tired of torturing me and decides to pull down the blinds?"
There was no answer. The little girl in the blue nightie, the little girl who had once been her, was gone. Now there was only darkness behind Jessie's closed lids, like the darkness of a movie screen after the show is ended. So she opened her eyes again and took a long look around the room where she was going to die. She looked from the bathroom door to the framed batik butterfly, to the bureau, to her husband's body, lying beneath its noxious throw rug of sluggish autumn flies.
"Quit it, Jess. Go back to the eclipse."
Her eyes widened. That actually did sound real. A real voice coming not from the bathroom or the hall or from inside her own head, but seeming to seep out of the very air itself.
"Punkin."
Her voice was only a croak now. She tried to sit up a little more, but another ferocious cramp threatened her midsection, and she lay back against the headboard at once, waiting for it to pass.
"Punkin, is that you? Is it, dear?"
For a moment, she thought she heard something, that the voice said something else, but if it did, she was unable to make out the words, and then it was entirely gone.
"Go back to the eclipse, Jessie."
"No answers there," she muttered. "Nothing there but pain and stupidity and what? What else? The old Adam." The phrase rose naturally into her mind, lifted from some sermon she must have heard as a bored child, sitting between her mother and father, kicking her feet in order to watch the light falling through the colored church windows shift and glimmer on her white patent leather shoes. Just some phrase that had caught on sticky flypaper in her subconscious and stayed with her. "The old Adam." And maybe that was all of it. As simple as that. A father who had half-consciously arranged to be alone with his pretty, vivacious young daughter, thinking all the while, there won't be any harm in it. No harm, not a bit of harm. Then the eclipse had started. And she had sat on his lap in the sundress that was both too tight and too short, the sundress he himself had asked her to wear. And what had happened had happened. Just a brief, goatish interlude that had shamed and embarrassed them both. He had squirted his squirt. That was the long and short of it. And if there was some sort of pun buried in there, she didn't give a shit about it. Had shot it all over the back of her underwear, in fact. Definitely not approved behavior for daddies, and definitely not a situation she had ever seen explored on the Brady Bunch. But let's face it, Jesse thought. I got off with barely a scratch compared to what could have happened. What does happen every day. It doesn't just happen in places like Peyton Place and along Tobacco Road, either. My father wasn't the first college-educated upper-middle-class man to ever get a hard-on for his daughter. And I wasn't the first daughter to ever find a wet spot on the back of her underpants. That's not to say it was right, or even excusable. It's just to say that it's over, and it could have been a lot worse. Yes. And right now, forgetting all that seemed a much better idea than going through it yet again, no matter what Punkin had to say on the subject. Best to let it fade into the general darkness which came with any solar eclipse. She still had a lot of dying to do in this stinking, fly-filled bedroom. She closed her eyes, and immediately the scent of her father's cologne seemed to drift into her nose. That and the smell of his light, nervous sweat. The feel of the hard thing against her bottom. His little gasp as she squirmed on his lap, trying to get comfortable. Feeling his hand as it settled lightly on her breast. Wondering if he was all right. He had begun to breathe so fast. Marvin Gaye on the radio. I love too hard, my friends sometimes say, but I believe that a woman should be loved that way.
Do you love me, Punkin?
Yes, sure.
Then don't worry about anything. I'd never hurt you.
Now his other hand was moving up her bare leg, pushing the sundress ahead of it, bunching it in her lap.
I want
to be sweet to you, Jesse muttered, shifting a little against the headboard. Her face was sallow and drawn.
That's what he said. Good Christ, he actually said that.
Everybody knows, especially you girls, that a love can be sad. Well, my love is twice as bad.
I'm not sure I want to, Daddy. I'm afraid of burning my eyes. You have another 20 seconds. At least that. So don't worry. And don't look around.
Then there had been the snap of elastic, not hers, but his, as he set the old Adam free. In defiance of her advancing dehydration, a single tear slipped from Jessie's left eye and rolled slowly down her cheek.
I'm doing it, she said in a hoarse, choked voice. I'm remembering. I hope you're happy.
Yes, Punkin said, and although Jessie could no longer see it, she could feel that strange, sweet gaze on her.
You've gone too far, though. Back up a little. Just a little.
An enormous sense of relief washed through Jessie as she realized the thing Punkin wanted her to remember had not happened during or after her father's sexual advances, but before them, although not long before.
Then why did I have to go through the rest of that awful old stuff?
The answer to that was pretty obvious, she supposed. It didn't matter if you wanted one sardine or 20. You still had to open the can and look at all of them. You had to smell that horrible fish oil stink. And besides, a little ancient history wasn't going to kill her. The handcuffs holding her on the bed might, but not these old memories, painful as they might be. It was time to quit bitching and moaning and get down to business. Time to find whatever it was Punkin said she was supposed to find.
Go back to just before he started to touch you that other way. The wrong way. Go back to the reason why the two of you were out there in the first place. Go back to the eclipse.
Jessie closed her eyes tighter and went back.
Punkin, all right?
Yes, but it's a little scary, isn't it?
Now she doesn't have to look into the reflector box to know something's happening. The day is beginning to darken the way it does when a cloud passes over the sun. But this is no cloud. The murk has unraveled, and what clouds there are lie quite far to the east.
Yes, he says.
And when she glances at him, she is enormously relieved to see he means it. Want to sit on my lap, Jess?
Can I?
You bet. So she does, glad of his nearness and warmth and his sweet smell, the smell of Daddy, as the day continues to darken. Glad most of all because it is a little scary, scarier than she imagined it would be. What scares her the most is the way their shadows on the deck are fading. She has never seen shadows fade quite like this before, and is almost positive she never will again. That's perfectly okay with me, she thinks, and snuggles closer. Glad to be, at least for the duration of this slightly spooky interlude, her father's Punkin again instead of plain old Jessie. Too tall, too gawky, too squeaky.
Can I look through the smoked glass yet, Dad?
Not yet. His hand heavy and warm on her leg. She puts her own hand over it and turns to him and grins.
It's exciting, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is, Punkin. Quite a bit more than I thought it would be, actually. She wriggles again, wanting to find a way to coexist with a hard part of him against which her bottom is now resting. He draws in a quick, hissing mouthful of air over his bottom lip.
Daddy, am I too heavy? Did I hurt you?
No, you're fine.
Can I look at it through the glass yet?
Not yet, Punkin. But very soon. The world no longer has the look it gets when the sun dives into a cloud. Now it seems as if twilight has come in the middle of the afternoon. She hears the old hooty owl in the woods, and the sound makes her shiver. On WNCH, Debbie Reynolds is fading out, and the DJ who comes in on top will soon be replaced by Marvin Gaye.
Look out on the lake,
Daddy tells her. And when she does, she sees a weird twilight creeping over a lackluster world from which every strong color has been subtracted, leaving nothing but subdued pastels. She shivers and tells him it's creepy. He tells her to try not to be too scared to enjoy it, a statement she will examine carefully, too carefully perhaps, for double meanings years later. And now,
Dad? Daddy? It's gone. Can I?
Yes. Now it's okay. But when I say you have to stop, you have to stop. No arguments, understand? He gives her three panes of smoked glass in a stack, but first he gives her a potholder. He gives it to her because he made the viewers from panes of glass cut from an old shed window, and he is less than confident of his abilities with a glass cutter. As she looks down at the potholder, in this experience which is both dream and memory, her mind suddenly leaps even further back, as nimbly as an acrobat turning a flip, and she hears him say, "The last thing I need is..." is for your mother to come home and find a note saying... Jessie's eyes flashed open as she spoke these words to the empty room, and the first thing they saw was the empty glass, Gerald's water glass, still standing on the shelf. Standing there near the cuff binding her wrist to the bedpost. Not the left wrist, but the right. A note saying I've taken you to the emergency room so they can try to sew a couple of your fingers back on. Now Jesse understood the purpose of that old, hurtful memory. Understood what Punkin had been trying to tell her all along. The answer had nothing to do with the old Adam, or with the faint mineral smell of the wet spot on her old cotton underpants. It had everything to do with half a dozen panes of glass, carefully cut from the crumbling putty of an old shed window. She had lost the jar of Nivea cream, but there was still at least one other source of lubrication left to her, wasn't there? One other way to ooze on over to the promised land. There was blood. Until it clotted, blood was almost as slippery as oil. It's going to hurt like hell, Jesse. Yes, of course it would hurt like hell. But she thought she had heard or read somewhere that there were fewer nerves in the wrists than at many of the body's vital checkpoints. That was why slitting one's wrists, especially in a tub full of hot water, had been a preferred method of suicide ever since the original toga parties in Imperial Rome. Besides, she was half numb already. I was half numb to let him lock me up in these things in the first place, she croaked. If you cut too deep, you'll bleed to death just like those old Romans. Yes, of course she would. But if she didn't cut at all, she'd lie here until she died of seizures or dehydration, or until her friend with a bag of bones showed up tonight. Okay, she said. Her heart was pumping very hard, and she was fully awake for the first time in hours. Time restarted with a ram and a jerk, like a freight train pulling out of a siding and back onto the main line. Okay, that's the convincer. Listen, a voice said urgently, and Jesse realized with amazement that it was the voice of Ruth and the goodwife. They had merged, at least for the time being. Listen carefully, Jess. I'm listening, she told the empty room. She was also looking. It was the glass she was looking at. One of a set of 12 she'd gotten on sale at Sears 3 or 4 years ago. 6 or 8 of them broken by now. Soon there would be another. She swallowed and grimaced. It was like trying to swallow around a flannel-covered stone lodged in her throat. I'm listening very carefully. Believe me. Good. Because once you start this, you won't be able to stop again. Everything's got to happen fast, because your system is already dehydrated. But remember this. Even if things go all wrong, they'll work out just fine, she finished. And it was true, wasn't it? The situation had taken on a simplicity that was, in its own ghastly way, sort of elegant. She didn't want to bleed to death. Of course, who would? But it would be better than the intensifying cramps and the thirst. Better than him. It. The hallucination. Whatever it was. She licked her dry lips with her dry tongue and caught at her flying, confused thoughts, tried to put them in order, as she had done before going after the sample jar of face cream, which was now lying uselessly on the floor beside the bed. It was getting harder to think, she discovered. She kept hearing snatches of "Go crazy," that talking blues, kept smelling her father's cologne, kept feeling that hard thing against her bottom. And then there was Gerald. Gerald seemed to be talking to her from his place on the floor. It's going to be back, Jesse. Nothing you can do will stop it. It will teach you a lesson. Me proud beauty. She flicked her eyes toward him, then looked hastily back at the water glass. Gerald appeared to be grinning ferociously at her, with a part of his face which the dog had left intact. She made another effort to set her wits to work, and after some effort the thoughts began to roll. She took 10 minutes, going over the steps again and again. There wasn't much, in truth, to go over. Her agenda was suicidally risky, but not complicated. She mentally rehearsed each move several times just the same, looking for the minor mistake which might cost her last chance at life. She couldn't find it. In the end, there was only one major drawback. It would have to be done very fast, before the blood could start to coagulate. And there were only two possible outcomes, a quick escape or unconsciousness and death. She reviewed the whole thing one more time, not putting off the necessary nasty business, but examining it the way she would have examined a scarf she had knitted for runs and dropped stitches, while the sun continued its steady westward run. On the back stoop, the dog got up, leaving the glistening knot of gristle upon which it had been gnawing. It ambled toward the woods. It had caught a whiff of that black scent again, and with its belly full, even a whiff was too much. Twelve, 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 the clock flashed, and whatever time it really was, it was time. One more thing before you start. You've got yourself nerved up to the sticking point, and that's good. But keep your focus. If you start off by dropping that damn glass on the floor, you really will be fucked.
Stay out, dog!
She called shrilly, with no idea that the dog had retreated to the stand of woods beyond the head of the driveway some minutes before. She hesitated a moment longer, considering another prayer, and then decided she had done all the praying she intended to do. Now she would depend on her voices and on herself. She reached for the glass with her right hand, moving without her former tentative care. Part of her, probably the part which had so liked and admired Ruth Neary, understood that this final job was not about care and caution, but about bringing down the hammer and bringing it down hard. Now I must be samurai lady, she thought, and smiled. She closed her fingers upon the glass she had worked so hard to get in the first place, looked at it curiously for a moment, looked at it as a gardener might look at some unexpected specimen she has found growing in among her beans or peas, then gripped it. She slitted her eyes almost completely shut to protect them from flying splinters, then brought the glass down hard on the shelf, in the manner of one who cracks the shell of a hard-boiled egg. The sound the glass made was absurdly familiar, absurdly normal, a sound no different than that made by the hundreds of glasses which had either slipped through her fingers during the washing up or been knocked onto the floor by her elbow or straying hand, in all the years since she had graduated from her plastic dandy duck cup at the age of 5. Same old kershmash. There was no special resonance to indicate the fact that she had just begun the unique job of risking her life in order to save it. She did feel a single random chunk of glass strike low on her forehead, just above the eyebrow, but that was the only one to hit her face. Another piece, a big one by the sound, spun off the shelf and shattered on the floor. Jessie's lips were pressed together in a tight white line, anticipating what would surely be the major source of pain, at least to begin with, her fingers. They had been gripping the glass tightly when it shattered. But there was no pain, only a sense of faint pressure and even fainter heat. Compared to the cramps which had been ripping at her for the last couple of hours, it was nothing. The glass must have broken lucky. And why not? Isn't it time I had a little luck? Then she raised her hand and saw the glass hadn't broken Lucky after all. Dark red blisters of blood were welling up at the tips of her thumb and three of her four fingers. Only her pinky had escaped being cut. Shards of glass stuck out of her thumb, second and third fingers like weird quills. The creeping numbness in her extremities, and perhaps the keen edges on the pieces of glass which had cut her, had kept her from feeling the lacerations much, but they were there. As she watched, fat drops of blood began to patter down on the pink-quilted surface of the mattress, staining it a far darker color. Those narrow darts of glass, sticking out of her middle two fingers like pins from a pincushion, made her feel like throwing up even though there was nothing at all in her stomach.
"Some samurai lady you turned out to be,"
one of the UFO voices sneered.
"But they're my fingers," she cried at it. "Don't you see? They're my fingers."
She felt panic flutter, forced it back, and returned her attention to the chunk of water glass she was still holding. It was a curved upper section, probably a quarter of the whole, and on one side it had broken in two smooth arcs. They came to an almost perfect point, which glittered cruelly in the afternoon sun. A lucky break, that. Maybe. If she could keep her courage up. To her, this curving prong of glass looked like a fantastic fairy tale weapon, a tiny scimitar, something to be carried by a warlike pixie on its way to do battle beneath a toadstool.
"Your mind is wandering, dear," Punkin said. "Can you afford that?"
The answer, of course, was no. Jessie laid the quarter section of drinking glass back down on the shelf, placing it carefully so she would be able to reach it without serious contortions. It lay on its smooth, curved belly, the scimitar-shaped prong jutting out. A tiny spark of reflected sun glittered hotly at the tip. She thought it might do very well for the next job, if she was careful not to bear down too hard. If she did that, she would probably push the glass off the shelf or snap off the accidental blade shape.
"Just be careful," she said. "You won't need to bear down if you're careful, Jessie. Just pretend." But the rest of that thought, "You're carving roast beef,"
didn't seem very productive, so she blocked it before more than its leading edge could get through. She lifted her right arm, extending it until the handcuff chain was almost taut, and her wrist hovered above the gleaming hook of glass. She wanted very much to sweep away the rest of the glass littering the shelf. She sensed it waiting for her up there like a minefield, but she didn't dare. Not after her experience with a jar of Nivea cream. If she accidentally knocked the blade-shaped piece of glass off the shelf or broke it, she would need to sift through the leftovers for an acceptable substitute. Such precaution seemed almost surreal to her, but she did not for a single moment try to tell herself they were unnecessary, for she was going to get out of this. She was going to have to bleed a lot more than she was bleeding now.
"Do it just the way you saw it, Jessie, that's all. And don't chicken out."
"No chickening out,"
Jessie agreed, in her harsh dust-in-the-cracks voice. She spread her hand and then shook her wrist, hoping to get rid of the glass poking out of her fingers. She mostly succeeded. Only the sliver in her thumb, buried deeply in the tender flesh beneath the nail, refused to go. She decided to leave it and get on with the rest of her business.
"What you're planning to do is absolutely crazy,"
a nervous voice told her. "No UFO here." This was a voice Jessie knew well. It was the voice of her mother. "Not that I'm surprised, you understand. It's a typical Jessie Mayhoot overreaction, and if I've seen it once, I've seen it 1,000 times. Think about it, Jessie. Why cut yourself up and maybe bleed to death? Someone will come and rescue you. Anything else is simply unthinkable. Dying in one summer house? Dying in handcuffs?" utterly ridiculous, take my word for it. So rise above your usual whiny nature, Jesse, just this one time. Don't cut yourself on that glass. Don't you do it. That was her mother, all right. The mimicry was so good it was eerie. She wanted you to believe you were hearing love and common sense, masquerading as anger. And while the woman had not been entirely incapable of love, Jesse thought the real Sally Mayhoot was the one who had one day marched into Jesse's room and thrown a pair of high heels at her without a single word of explanation, either then or later. Besides, everything that voice had said was a lie, a scared lie. "No," she said, "I won't take your word for it. No one's coming, except maybe the guy from last night. No chickening out." With that, Jessie lowered her right wrist toward the gleaming blade of glass.